At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Cozy traditions feel good, and that includes your fall makeup look. From lashes for days to enhancing a smoky eye with your favorite shade of Brilliant Eye Brightener, Thrive Cosmetics is your go-to for completing every fall look. Plus, every product is 100% vegan, cruelty-free, and made with clean, skin-loving ingredients. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/cozy for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics. CAUSEMETICS.com/cozy.
How long is Donald Trump going to share the stage with Elon Musk? And how long is Elon Musk going to share the stage with
not forever
with
is
Vivek
the answer.
Ramaswamy? I mean, come on. Okay. Are they all going to take the oath of office together on January 20th? What about J.D. Vance?
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I am your host, as always, Rick Wilson, and I want to welcome a very special guest today. Tim Naftali is a historian, a guy who understands our presidents both in their historical context and in how former presidents and prior presidents have shaped the office today. He is the author of one of my favorite books about my old boss, George H.W. Bush, which was a puff piece, but it certainly caught, I think, H.W. in a lot of ways that not everybody did. And he's also the author of one of the greatest articles of the last few years about Donald Trump being the worst president. He wrote that right in the wake of January 6th. And I'm going to guess a lot has changed. So I want to welcome you to the show, Tim. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Rick.
Talk to me about the question that people are going to ask me if I don't ask you. Talk to me about the question of Donald Trump in historical context and give us some perspective, not only in the sweep of our 250 years, but in the modern era where, you know, you can't always compare apples to oranges in presidents, but in the modern era, talk to us about where Trump sits in that scale of behavior.
Let me answer this in two different ways. Let me try to answer the big question of where he sits in general, and then I'll get to the issue of his behavior. The election, there was a lot resting on the election, the future of Ukrainian sovereignty, the future of rights in the United States, the strength of the U.S. dollar. There are a lot of things that rested on the 2024 election, I needn't tell you.
Sure.
One of the things that rested on that election was also Donald Trump's historical legacy. Because had he lost, then his legacy would be inextricably linked to January 6th. And there would be a sense of a national consensus about what that meant. I mean, after all, in many ways, the Democrats had a number of arguments, but I think they're next to the reproductive rights issue, their central argument was that Donald Trump was not a normal candidate. And in a sense, was disqualified historically, politically, morally. I don't need to tell you this. You know this very well. Well, the American people, in their infinite wisdom, decided, no, we're going to treat him like a normal candidate. We're going to just say, look, we're not happy with the economy, and you know where I'm going with this. Now, had Donald Trump's political career ended with January 6th, I think one could make the argument he was a blip, he was an aberration. There are a lot of arguments one could make, but he was reelected. And though January 6th, I believe, will forever remain a stain on his political career, his significance to our country's history is much deeper now.
Right.
Because he is He is an avatar. He's not just a Pied Piper. He's an avatar, something deeper that's going on. And so I hope you'll ask me in 4 years after we see what comes of a second Trump administration. But I think that his larger significance for American history is being written at the moment. Now, his behavior, that was your other part. His behavior, and I wrote a, thank you very much for mentioning it. I wrote a piece for The Atlantic in January of 2021. And I laid out I tried to be a referee or an umpire. I wasn't playing favorites or the opposite, right? I tried to explain that the most important thing a president could do is to keep our country together and not try to tear up our Constitution. And for me, January 6th made Donald Trump a worse president than even James Buchanan. Right. And I won't, you know, if you're
folks, it's a high bar with Buchanan.
High bar, but very high. And I explain why. And your listeners can read it if they want. The concern I have right now is that Donald Trump has promised us to behave worse than he did in his first term. And he ran on that, and the American people arguably gave him a mandate, or at least gave him the idea that he has a mandate to do this. And then the Supreme Court last summer did something extraordinarily bad, which was to enable the imperial presidency. And if we, if you'd like to talk more about that, I'd love to talk.
I absolutely would. Well, I'm actually coming to that.
So again, that's why I say we need to talk in 4 years. What will Donald Trump do with an apparent mandate to act badly against his perceived adversaries and a Supreme Court right to cover a lot of this in terms of official duties and therefore beyond criminal prosecution? I don't know the answer yet.
That is one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I'm glad you brought it up, because we have had other presidents push executive power, Republicans and Democrats. We've had both parties shove executive power, as Congress has in the last 100 years, or 75 years, let's say. As Congress has started to abrogate some of its responsibilities, the executive has kind of filled that vacuum. But none of them ever combined two things: the sociopathic disdain for the rule of law and a get out of jail free card from the Supreme Court for almost any action, even tangentially related to official duties as the president. Talk to us about the risk and the danger to the entire system of not only the presidency, but the Constitution and the country, by empowering Trump at this level, given the powers of the executive.
Well, let's go back a couple hundred years and talk about the concept of separation of powers. And we can talk about the blind spots of the founding generation. Fine. And they had many.
Okay. Plenty.
But,
sure.
But one of the central insights they had is that human beings can do bad things, and that human beings are greedy for power, for money, for influence, and therefore you need institutions to curb them. They understood that George Washington was mortal, that he would not be president forever, and therefore you needed a Congress and a court to keep everybody in check. But they made a mistake, and this was the blind spot, one of them. They didn't conceive of parties. They didn't understand there would be a Martin Van Buren, or Andrew Jackson, if you will. That you would have created contrary loyalties in the tripartite system. What I mean by that is the loyalty to the Constitution is number one. But they didn't realize that people in the Congress would have a loyalty to the president, and that loyalty might lead them or mislead them to make decisions that undermine the basic check and balance system in order to benefit their ally in the White House. They just, the founders knew something called faction. They didn't like those. In many ways, what we saw with the Republican Party was a faction. Now it's a part. Now it's as Mitt Romney said the other day, it's MAGA. But for a while, it was fighting with itself, and you had a faction, which was MAGA, and everybody else. Well, I'm afraid now it's all MAGA. So the founders didn't anticipate that. So fast forward to now, where effectively impeachment and removal are dead as sanctions.
Right.
It's not going to happen. And so a president knows that they've got 4 years, that they could do what they want for 4 years. They're not going to be removed. Now, what does the Supreme Court do? In the summer, and this, by the way, is not related as much to Trump as I think some people think. This is related to a longstanding debate among conservative jurists that comes in reaction to Watergate and in reaction to the changes in the 70s where the Congress, with the help of two presidents, one Republican, Gerald Ford, one Democrat, Jimmy Carter, empowered themselves to put limits on the presidency. And one of the, you know, sometimes our country seems full of providence and good luck, and sometimes our country is deeply unlucky. This is a case of being deeply unlucky. We had, if you will, a collision between an elite conservative juridical debate and Donald Trump's own criminal problems. And that collision created an opportunity for Federalists to make an argument they've been wanting to make for 25 years, which empowers the presidency. But they did it in the era of Trump. What they were doing was they were empowering somebody who was going to use this, at least he was telling us he was going to use it. He's going to use it for bad reasons. So this is what happened in the summer. And then the American people reelect Donald Trump in November, setting the stage for the opportunity for the worst series of presidential abuse of power we have ever seen in our history.
You know, I've got to imagine when Madison was writing Federalist 10 and worrying about faction, that the idea of parties alone would have been concerning to him, but the idea of a sort of cult-like movement that almost harkens back to the monarchical things that they were fighting against would have absolutely horrified him. Which I always find this ironic, because it's like conservatives have now taken on this, oh, we're the ones who believe in the Constitution. We believe in the Constitution. Actually, not really. It's so striking. I mean, 10 and 51. And when you get to Federalist 51 and talking about executive power, yes, they wanted a strong executive, especially in times of crisis and war and all that. But it's so far beyond, I think, what the founders could have conceivably imagined that we'd be facing today.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, look, I believe, and you would know this a lot better than me, Rick. I have been an observer of the conservative movement. I have not been a participant.
Sure.
But the conservative movement fractured in part because of culture. Not only the culture of the movement, but the issue of culture.
Yes.
And you ended up having people who actually would be much more comfortable in top-down authoritarian regimes who, in an effort to protect their own culture, and by the way, I'm sympathetic to people who don't want to be, you know, pushed around and want to be able to live the lives they want to live.
Sure.
But they sought power in order to impose a certain cultural set of values on others, which doesn't fit, to my mind, conservatism, certainly is not associated with libertarianism, and certainly was not the way the founders thought of the plural system they were creating. Now, again, when they describe we the people, they're not describing the entirety of the American America we love
Correct.
And know today. But
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
they did believe in religious pluralism. I mean, there is a beautiful, there are beautiful statements from George Washington.
Oh God, yes.
But what happens, and again, you'd know better than me, is within the conservative movement, that taste for religious pluralism disappears.
It does. And one of the reasons it disappears that we have yet to reconcile in this country is there are certain virulent aspects of anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism that rear their ugly heads in every authoritarian movement. And as I, in my opinion, at least as MAGA transformed from a conservative movement to an autocratic or authoritarian, however you want to phrase it, movement, it became much more difficult to suppress and to keep those things, you know, in the back of the house, as it were. I mean, I tell this story a lot. When people look at today's party, you know, it's hard for them to remember that when David Duke ran for governor of Louisiana as a racist anti-Semite, George Herbert Walker Bush didn't say, okay, well, he's in our party, so we can't do anything about it.
Oh.
He sent guys like me, hundreds of us, dozens of us, down to Louisiana to beat his ass. And I just find it so stunning that that the party left that legacy completely behind.
Well, if
it is gone.
Yeah. Well, a moment on George Herbert Walker Bush, one of my favorite presidents. I don't think he's ever been fully appreciated.
100% agree.
I think that today's MAGA party would view him as a rhino if they even knew who he was. They certainly know his son. And the honesty, the decency, the good judgment of George Herbert Walker Bush is something we desperately need today. But I don't see much of it, frankly.
No, it's become a very unfashionable and you know, reviled, frankly, part of the history of the movement, because they really don't like the idea of a president with. They look at that when you bring up HW's dignity and his respect for people, they look at that as a critique of Trump. They look at that as a critique of themselves as well, because they're like, oh, well, why would we care about manners and decency and honor and the truth? They find that offensive that those things are even in the discussion in a lot of ways.
You know, again, it's history. I love talking about it, but when you're talking to younger people, they may find that this is ancient history. But I think it's really important for those who want to see the renewal of American conservatism, and I'm one of those. I may not share all the same.
Sure.
Beliefs, but I believe deeply that this country desperately needs a sane conservative movement, desperately, just as it needs a sane liberal movement. And we can talk about that too, if you want. But here's what I want people to think about. I don't want them to think about Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, because I think that relationship has been completely exaggerated. I want them to think about George Herbert Walker Bush's relationship with Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Because people don't know this, but, you know, there was good reason for Ronald Reagan never to want George Bush near him in the White House, given the nature of George Bush's attacks on Ronald Reagan in that campaign. And again, you know this, but it's a long time ago. And the fact that now I credit James Baker for this, but not alone. The fact that these two formed a team. Now, they didn't become best friends, and I know for a fact that the Bushes were not invited up to the residence of the White House because Mrs. Bush told me that. But the fact is, they formed a team for the betterment of the country. It was good for the party too, but for the betterment of the country, and it resulted in George Herbert Walker Bush being the anointed one by Ronald Reagan, even though Pat Buchanan, and there's a name, he's still with us, I think, but there's a name that's
he's still around.
But the Pat Buchanan thought he was the rightful inheritor of the Reagan mantle. Anyway, the reason I bring up that old history is that these were two Republicans who were quite different in their philosophies, but were both decent, respectful, people who believed that the party needed dignity. That's all. That's the only reason I want to bring it up. Because
it's so true, though. They both had a fundamental respect for the country, and both looked at the party as an apparatus that was serving the country, not simply, you know. I always go back to this kind of weird, like, there's a feel around Trump that's always rattled me a little bit. It's that sort of North Korean dear leader feel. It's that you know, the caudillo, the Latin American, you know, strongman figure, which a lot of people now look at as the superior model for presidential leadership. And I just find that, I will never not find that disturbing and ahistorical to what we claim our values are in this country.
Well, I totally agree. I want to make two points about that. One is that that Donald Trump is a master at saying the quiet part out loud. There are many ways in which the darker side of Richard Nixon connects to some of the urges of Donald Trump. But Richard Nixon never said it out loud. He taped himself saying it, which brought an end to his administration.
Also a problem, yeah.
Yes. But the fact is, he knew, or at least he thought, that the America of the 1970s would not abide that overt darkness.
Right.
That if people understood the demons he had within, he would never be electable. No. And I think the sadness today is the fact that you can win an election by showing that darkness, or despite showing it. I don't think all 77 million people who voted for Donald Trump like the darkness. Many of them just held their nose. But the fact is, you're still electable. And that to me is very worrying, because it does show a whole new generation of politicos. Those young people are very impressionable, and that you can win this way. And then the other thing I wanted to mention about the caudillo, because I think that's a very useful analogy, much better than looking to Europe, unless you're looking at Francisco Franco,
right.
The other thing that's key is that in this transition already, not only is Trump acting like the president, and it's partly because the incumbent is so feeble right now, but it's also, look what he's doing with governments around the world. He's already threatening governments, and we're beginning to see them fall.
Yes.
In anticipation of this next moment. I mean, the German government failed today. The French government failed. The Canadian government is in trouble. We are already seeing these governments trying to figure out what to do in the next era. And Donald Trump hasn't even taken the oath of office.
So right.
One of the things that I'm going to be watching, and I'm sure you will be too, and many others who are listening will be watching, is the extent to which the fact that Donald Trump was reelected, just the very fact that he's reelected, is going to reorder the political struggle between the far right and everybody else throughout the developed world.
I think that's exactly one of the things we should be watching most closely is there's a global authoritarian movement. It's not trivial. It's an actual thing, folks. And that movement, is, you know, having Trump at the sort of center of that movement, I think, is another thing that's unique for an American president, not in a good way. It is that idea that this guy that looks up to and empowers the Orbans of the world, the Putins of the world, the Xis of the world, even when they are hostile to American interests. They're putting the interests of that authoritarian movement ahead of American interests by a long, long way.
Well, you remember in John Bolton's memoir, he makes it clear that and John Bolton spent a lot of time talking foreign policy with Donald Trump, that Donald Trump actually had no sense of national interest at all. It's all his own interests. So you say that it's true that Xi and Putin and Orban, less Orban. I mean, Orban is,
yeah.
Hungary's not really a player. It's a disruptor.
No. Yes.
Sorry, Hungarians, but they have the power to, great food though.
Yes.
That, the point is that these disruptors, if they give Donald Trump what he wants, he's not thinking strategically about what's in the interest of the United States.
No, it still comes down to being what's about him,
yeah.
Which I find to be the sort of disturbing undertone of, they all know that if they flatter him appropriately or inappropriately, he's going to do what they want.
Yes.
And he likes it. That's their secret sauce to making Donald Trump, you know, bark like a dog.
Corruption. I worry about what we saw in the first impeachment being the nature of our foreign policy.
Yes.
Demanding, to remind people, the perfect phone call, where basically Donald Trump was holding hostage necessary military assistance to the Ukrainians, who were under strain, mm-hmm. stress even then from Russia, in return for a promise to help him with a political dirty trick against the Biden family.
Right.
And so unless there's some miraculous shift in Donald Trump, which I don't anticipate, but we have to say that because history hasn't been written yet. Unless there's some miraculous shift, we can anticipate that our foreign policy is going to be have the same lodestone, if you will, over the next 4 years.
I think that's right. Well, it is certainly, in my mind, we are living in history in beyond that normal, you know, may you live in interesting times cliche. We are living in a moment of history, I think, that is insanely unprecedented. We really have not had, I still come down to this, Tim. It's like, You got it right. You could run by showing the darkness. You could win by showing the ugliness. You could win by showing the worst elements of humanity and of character. And since we've never been in this thing before, I know it's rather speculative, but what do you see as the outcome of a country that has to face up to, you know, having voted for? And as much as I dislike it, I think Donald Trump won the election.
He sure
did. I'm not in a fantasy world. But what do you see? How do you see the country moving past this legacy, moving into a new era? Because at some point it will. At some point we will have a different set of outcomes politically.
Okay, well, I'm a cautious optimist. I'm very worried about Ukraine. I'm very worried about what I anticipate will happen
sure.
abroad. I really do think some terrible things are going to happen. I fear that the Zelensky government is going to collapse, for example. And in any case, but at home, I anticipate some tough times. But there are some elements of our society that get us through this period, any period like this. And we've been through mm-hmm. one of the joys and curses of being a historian is that you know that things have been worse.
Right.
That's really important, okay? Because so here are a few things that I'm looking for and that keep my optimism. It's not a raging optimism, but it's optimism alive. The dynamism of our society.
Sure.
We talk about it, but, you know, we really ought to focus on what this means. The fact that, you know, again and again, we're the center for technological change in the world. It's very disruptive.
Mm-hmm.
Technological change happens before societies are ready for it.
Always.
I think it's one of the great lessons of the Oppenheimer movie, which is a little long in my view, but it was a good movie, obviously. It's that, you know, scientific change happens before we're ready for it, whether we like it or not.
Sure.
And so the the that dynamism means that our economy is unlikely to stagnate.
Mm-hmm.
And that dynamism means that young people will have new kinds of jobs to compete for. And,
right.
And that's really important. Okay. So I anticipate that will continue. I anticipate that even though checks and balances in Washington are have been neutralized, they haven't been neutralized across the country. That if the president tries to put tariffs up to the levels that he's threatened other countries with, and I think he's threatening that, I think largely for theatrical reasons, but also to push these governments over the edge, mm-hmm. you're going to see pushback around the country.
Yeah, they get a vote.
Another thing, I think that besides the personal pushback, because, you know, how long is Donald Trump going to share the stage with Elon Musk? And how long is Elon Musk going to share the stage with
not forever
with
is
Vivek
the answer.
Ramaswamy? I mean, come on. Okay. Are they all going to take the oath of office together on January 20th? What about J.D. Vance? There's not enough room for the four of them. I've been watching them go to the Army, Navy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, besides that little bit of sort of inside politics, what about when you've got these cabinet secretaries, even though they're all his choices, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Doge tells them to cut their staff. And these secretaries right. want to be successful. They don't want all to be failures. And what about the pushback from Congress when they? So I'm anticipating that even though it's not going to be the brilliant tripartite checks and balances the framers anticipated, that the very nature of the cross-cutting interests in our society will have some restraining effect on certain efforts by Donald Trump. So therefore, it's the dynamism of our economy. It's the dynamism of our people. It's our basic desire to be left alone, okay? And mm-hmm. and I think it's the fact that Joe Biden will leave us with a very strong economy that I think will result in a more complicated political environment for a wannabe Caudillo.
I am glad to end any show on an optimistic note, and that is an optimistic note. It really is, and the idea that we have the potential for that providential nature of America, that resilience in America to sustain, is something that I think that a lot of our friends on the left have had a very rough time. They've had a very rough time of accepting that Trump is not necessarily forever. He is not, you know, like all men, he is mortal. And it's not necessarily going to be the assembly of Trump's coalition in the future is not necessarily going to be as easy as all that. And I think that one other thing is that we all know that presidential power is limited. It's always on a clock. And in the second term, it's always on a clock. So I'm hoping we're going to have some more conversations like this in the future, Tim, that are a little more optimistic.
Can I add one more little bit of optimism before we go?
I'm all here for it.
It is the holiday season. I think it is very healthy that once again, both political parties are competing for the votes of people of color.
I agree.
I think that is one of the most important changes. And I think everyone benefits with that because it's a reminder that we're a commonwealth.
We really are. And that perspective, I think, is one that gets a little bit lost in the shuffle as the parties define themselves for a long time, just on demographics, just on these are our people, these are their people. And if we get past that, I think it's going to be good for the country and good for a sort of post-Trump. We're going to have a sort of, I don't want to use the phrase truth and reconciliation commission, but something in that respect. Both parties are going to have some hard decisions and hard lessons as we come out of the Trump era. So, well, with that, I want to thank you so much, Tim, for coming on the show today. Folks, Tim Naftali is a brilliant author, a brilliant historian. His books are very much worth your perspective and your time. And Tim, I want to thank you again for coming on the show, and we will talk to you next time.
Thanks, Rick. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas.
Everyone.
You too.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joseph Werner-Cheney. Produced and edited by Whitney Hayes and Jeff Taylor.
And good luck.
Hey, everybody. If you would like to get in touch, if you have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just general questions, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. That's podcast@lincolnproject.us.